begin just by saying that I'm Cynthia Molovita, and this is the session related to love in the time of climate change. So is that where you meant to be? Okay, you're on the right plane, good. I am just so grateful that we can be here together working on this difficult material. I thought perhaps we would open with just a moment. Is that rumbling me?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just a little bit. Yeah.
Okay. How's that?
That's
good. Is that better?
Oops, it's still rumbling.
Okay. Let's open with a moment of gratitude. And you're welcome to close your eyes if you like. Well, we give thanks for the vast community of communities that enabled us to wake up this morning, to be present in this beauty. We give thanks for our ancestors who brought us to life. We give thanks for our children and other young people who renew in us hope and joy. We give thanks for the incredible array of creatures and critters, the millions and billions, perhaps trillions, that live in our bodies. All the little teeny microscopic creatures that live in our guts and in our tear ducts and on our hair and in our skin that enable us to breathe, without whom we would not breathe a breath. We give thanks for the trees of the Amazon that serve as our external ones. We give thanks for the bees that pollinate. We give thanks for all of the 4,000 creatures in a square foot of soil that enable the soil to bring us our food. We give thanks for the energy that comes from the sun. And we give thanks for the great creative and liberating and healing spirit that brought this all into being. May we use these gifts to further life and love and abundance for all on this planet. Amen. Well, it would be helpful first to know how many folks were not here Monday. Can I get a sense of, a lot of people. Okay, let us quickly, by way of introduction, go around and name in a word one gift, quality, resource that you bring to the work of climate justice or to the work of minimizing the impacts of climate change. Do you hear my question? Mm-hmm. One thing you bring, and just, in fact, we don't even need to go around in a circle, just name those things. A word apiece.
Intention.
Intention.
Awareness.
Ah.
Commitment.
Yes.
Concern,
great.
Creativity.
Pardon me?
Creativity.
Creativity.
Willingness to learn.
Willingness to learn. Good, we can put together three words. Yes.
Optimism.
Public voice.
Pardon me?
Public voice.
Public voice. Thank you.
Teaching children.
Great.
Reduction.
Anger. Listener.
Listening.
Mm-hmm.
Anger.
Advocacy.
The power of anger in the work of love. Good. Advocacy. Who said that? Ah, lovely. Good.
Time.
Retiring.
Time to do something.
No plastics.
No classes?
No plastics.
No plastics. Go, my friend. Yes.
Sharing.
What an array that we bring. Good. Thank you. We should spend a little bit of time reviewing where we were on Monday for those who were not here. especially the first half of Monday before we began talking about ways to respond. I had said that we would dare to enter into terrifying terrain, that is to acknowledge some terrible truths about climate injustice, or in theological terms, climate sin. And the fundamental reality that we discussed was that those people who are suffering and dying, losing their lands, their communities, their health, their lives to climate change now and in the future are disproportionately in the far larger part, not the people who are causing it or who come from the societies that have historically caused it. The people that we now have at least 25 million climate refugees, and the majority of them are highly impoverished, low-consuming people, also disproportionately people of color, not white people. Particularly peoples of Africa and Asia and small islands and coastal lands. But we call climate vulnerable people. We in this room are part of an incredibly high consuming society. Per capita, per person, we are, I think it's along with Australia, the most dangerous people, the most responsible for, currently and historically, the greenhouse gas emissions that generate climate change. So how do we deal with that morally? How do we deal with that spiritually? If the call of the Christian is to love neighbor as self, and if neighbor is a global phenomenon, if neighbor means whomever my life touches, then my life is touched by those people who are impacted by the climate change that I cause. So we are defying or betraying our fundamental reason for being. I thought that there might be a number of people who had not been here Monday. And I realized that one way, without going into all the details that we did Monday, but to share with you some of that reality and not just repeat what we did before, would be to read a few voices from climate vulnerable people. So I'll read just a few voices from a recent book called Climate Justice by Mary Robinson, who was the president of Ireland and has been highly involved in climate related issues. And I will read very, very briefly. Let's begin. The first voice is from Constance Okole, a small-scale farmer and community organizer from eastern Uganda. She says she had come to a conference in Cape Town from a nonprofit group in Uganda called Climate Wise Women. I have seen live what is happening on the ground, she said in a soft but deliberate voice. Everyone across the world should understand what is happening, that we, the people at the grassroots level, are suffering the worst effects of climate change. End quote. This woman recounted how her tiny village had been devastated since 2000 by drought, flash flooding, and erratic storms. In eastern Uganda, she says, there are no seasons anymore. Agriculture is a gamble. And now another voice or a description. The people of Alaska, 85% of whom live along the coast, are among the first Americans to feel the effects of climate change as the ground beneath them melts and gives way. This year, 31 Native communities across Alaska are contemplating their imminent destruction because of the dependence on fossil fuel emissions of their fellow citizens further south. So we're talking about indigenous communities. These shrinking communities are confronting an impossible choice to find tens of millions of dollars to uproot their centuries-old traditions and move their homes and the bones of their ancestors to higher ground, or to stay and use their limited resources to build a bulwark against the sea. Daunted by the cost of the latter and with little in federal assistance, many are choosing to leave. In August 2016, the residents of Shishmaref, are people familiar with Shishmaref? How many? Okay, great. An indigenous community north of the Bering Strait voted to relocate their entire community from their barrier island, which has for decades been disappearing into the sea. Some experts warn that many coastal Alaskan villages will be completely uninhabitable due to climate change by 2050. So, one additional voice. This now is the voice of Mary Robinson. I recently met women in the drought-stricken regions of Honduras. Honduras in Central America is very close to my heart. I spent 2 years as a missionary in that country working in nutrition. In the drought-stricken regions of Honduras, who no longer had water. I had seen the pain on the faces of these women. One of the women said to me, and I will never forget, "We have no water. How do you live without water?" The U.S., Mary Robinson goes on to say, has profound obligation as a big greenhouse gas emitter and historically an emitter that built its whole economy on fossil fuels that are now damaging the world. And finally, this again is the voice of the first woman we saw, no, the voice of another woman at that same meeting. I know that the people in developed countries are our friends. We are the same people. We have the same blood. But these people are enjoying their life while we are suffering. I wanted to know why they were doing this to us. I wanted to know whether the people in developed countries could reduce their emissions so that we could have our normal seasons back. End quote. So that is to share a little bit in story form of the reality with which we are grappling. Now, from these realities, search forth some tremendously life and death kinds of questions. One is, why on earth do we go on with life as it is, given that this is happening and that we have every capacity to know about it? So why do we do it? That is a truly important question. Václav Havel, former president of the Czech Republic, once in a speech said, one of the most critical questions facing humankind is why we go on acting in ways that are going to destroy us and not stop. I did my dissertation partly on moral agency, what enables and disables the moral agency to live in more justice-seeking ways. But that's not the question we're going to deal with right now. But it's one I put before you. What stops us from living differently? Another question, and this we'll deal with more on Friday, is wherein lies the kind of moral, spiritual fortitude to face the truth and not run away from it? Where lies the courage to resist betraying God's justice-seeking love as we do? Where do we find hope? But today, I'd like us to work on a more pragmatic question, and that is, what are we, as church, and as other caring, compassionate members of society, to do? What can we do about this? I would suggest to you first, before talking about what we can do, or to say that a first step is to have in mind a vision of what is possible. And by a vision right now, I'll mean two things. Imagine life ways in households, in institutions like churches, schools, in cities, in corporations. Imagine life ways that are actually not producing greenhouse gas emissions, that are carbon neutral, that are based on renewable energy, not fossil fuels, that are not doing the meat consumption that creates all of the methane. Imagine LifeWays 10 years from now, 7 years from now, that are carbon neutral. Okay, that's one thing to imagine. Secondly, imagine an economy, local economies, national, global economies that are moral. And I'll suggest moral as having three qualities. One, ecologically sustainable. Economic life that does not endanger Earth's life systems. By economic life, I mean what we buy and sell and invest, how business buys and sells and invests. Okay, economic life that is ecologically sustainable, so serving Earth's well-being. Secondly, equitable, building economic equity, reducing the gap between the rich and the poor, rather than concentrating wealth. What is it now? 75 human beings have wealth equal to half of humankind? So ecologically sustainable, economically equitable, and democratic, meaning participatory. That is, people have some say over the decisions that shape life and death. Economic decisions shape life and death. They determine who will have food, who will have water. So a moral economy would be more democratic, more ecological, more equitable. So I'm asking you just to imagine wildly for a minute a moral economy and life ways that are ecologically sustainable. Do you have any questions before you take a minute to imagine? Okay, just imagine what could be. What do you see in your mind's eye? What did you see with that imagining what could be?
Less suffering.
Pardon me?
Less suffering.
Less suffering?
For me, I am a person who is more successful when these choices are institutionalized and easier. So if someone's picking up my compost, which they don't do in San Diego,
yes,
I would be more likely to compost. And it'd be nice if I would do it anyway, but I just know I'm less likely to.
Beautiful. So you imagined a city that was, you said, picking up your compost. Okay, beautiful piece of it. And you're right. Things, it's not a matter of just what I do. It's institution. It's a very, very good point. Human beings sin. Human beings are imperfect. So part of the role of social structures, institutions, public policy, is to create conditions that we can live more rightly. So a city picking up compost would do that. What else did you imagine? Yes?
Well, for instance, we live in the Seattle area, which is known for its rain and lousy weather. But our church has put solar panels on our roof. And it's amazing how much electricity we are producing ourselves.
Okay.
We're not doing all of it, but it's a start. And we did it partly because the community can see as they drive by these solar panels. And in Seattle, you can have solar panels and it works.
Okay, we could spend a lot of time on that. We could spend a lot of time not on. So that's not only a church with solar panels. It's a church saying, look.
Yeah, it works.
All of these buildings and houses around here could have solar panels. Mm-hmm. This city or this country could make tax. What do we call it? Tax credits for solar panels. This country could fund research and development to make solar panels cheap instead of funding certain other things. Yes?
That's actually what happened. The state of Washington had a grant program where they paid for part of our solar panels for the church. So actually the church didn't have to put out that much money because of the grant to encourage organizations to put solar panels on.
So that's back to what you said in the corner about if institutions make things easier to do, such as that, it goes up to what Ron said in the top about advocacy. So one role is public policy advocacy to get those policies in place to make that possible.
One other thing that I would love to see would be labeling of carbon impact on pretty much everything somehow, so that people are aware of the carbon footprint of things.
Okay, beautiful. Imagine that. So we have public policy advocacy that says, let us get carbon impact, carbon footprint labeling on our products. That's going to take a lot of people pushing for that because, mind you, companies producing things with high carbon footprints are not going to want that on their products. So excellent. Yes, Emily.
Yeah, I was thinking also about solar panels and energy systems and like community cooperatively owned energy systems that are democratic and ownership not only of like the producing of the energy but the infrastructure as well.
Okay.
That was community owned.
So look at that. I asked you to image a moral economy that was ecologically sustainable and economically equitable and democratic. And so you've just been talking about a more democratic form of a piece of our economy, which is energy systems. So more and more communities are generating community-owned and run energy systems. So people do have then some say in what those policies will be. Excellent. And I'll also say that this is coming from the voice of someone who works for the Synod, and your job is environmental and environmental justice work with a Synod. So there's something an institution can do. Hire someone to do that, or call someone to do that.
One of the things that we can do, which I think fits in with a lot of the paradigms that you're putting together here, mm-hmm. is not feel like we have to develop everything ourselves.
Okay.
The Europeans are, in many countries, are far ahead of us, not only in mm-hmm. developing technologies, mm-hmm. but putting it to use and using legislation mm-hmm. to do exactly the kind of changes that you're talking mm-hmm. about. You know, rather than feeling like we have to start from scratch mm-hmm. and develop everything as if it didn't exist, let's look around the world and see what we can borrow from mm-hmm. other people's experiences. Mm-hmm.
Excellent, excellent. And that feeds smack into one of the things that I'm going to talk about very shortly when we look at toolboxes. So hold on to that. Borrowing from and aware of what's happening. Didn't Germany produce 75% of its fuel one recent year, of its energy by renewable energies? Costa Rica, I think, produced 100% of its energy by okay, excellent. So you have named, this is a smattering, and we'll talk more. Each of the things you've said feed into a kind of framework. And it's helpful to have a framework for the many kinds of actions needed to reach lifestyles that are ecologically sustainable and a more ecological, I'm sorry about my handwriting, economically equitable and democratic kinds of economies. Let me name for you what I have perceived to be a vexing paradox a vexing paradox that hinders our kind of moral spiritual power to move in the directions we've just been talking about. When I talk about moral spiritual power, or moral spiritual agency, I say moral spiritual because we're talking about the morality of our lives, our impact on others and ourselves, but also I would argue the spiritual power to move towards rightness, towards right relationships. We talk about in ethics moral spiritual agency as the power to move from the way things are toward the way things ought to be. So what elicits and what hinders moral spiritual power? I used to teach from the way things are to the way things ought be. And I realize that's disempowering in itself because we're never going to get all the way. If Martin Luther King Jr. had thought he was going to get to where he wanted to go, he probably would have done nothing, but he was getting toward it. So our moral spiritual power to move from a unbelievably suicidal course for the human species to life that enables Earth systems to flourish and people to have what they need. I would argue that one of the things that hinders us is this paradox. On the one hand, a lot, large sectors of our society just don't get it, don't recognize the magnitude of the crisis or our implication as causal factors in it. Do you sort of see that?
Yes.
That moral blindness, I would say? On the other hand, once you begin to get it, a foreboding sense of doom or powerlessness or despair or rage can set in and overpower the capacity to move forward. Have any of you experienced that? Yeah. In short, we can't meet the crisis of climate change without knowing what's going on. But the more we know about what's going on, the more powerless we might feel. Do you see what I'm saying about that paradox? So, a challenge lies before us, and that is to both see what's going on and move forward with hope and moral fortitude. One of the things that I think helps in that is having a sense of what ordinary people, we're ordinary people, we're not like superheroes, what ordinary people in this country can do to truly make a difference. Someone once said, what would you do in the next month and year if you really believed you could truly make a difference? So I'd like to say that to me it's helpful to think about a kind of toolbox, a toolbox for living toward the future that we crave and are called to by our God. The book that I mentioned yesterday, one of my books called Resisting Structural Evil, Love as Ecological Economic Vocation, creates and works with such a toolbox, amongst other things. And I had flyers for it, but I forgot them up in my room. I'll bring them Friday. What I'd like to do today is work with about four tools that are part of, that are developed in that book. And the first of those tools, let's look for a better pen. The first tool is the one that I mentioned yesterday. Holy cow. There we go. I call it critical mystical vision. And by that I mean seeing three things at once, recognizing what is going on, especially evil, good, excuse me, evil that parades as good. So the life that we live looks like a good life. And it's destroying Earth's capacity to sustain life. So I would say that's evil parading as good. Secondly, seeing what could be. What could and should be, which is part of what you were envisioning a moment ago. And third, seeing the presence of the God of the cosmos who creates and loves and redeems present on Earth, working us, luring us toward what could be. Are you with me there? Those are the three pieces of critical mystical vision, always to hold in mind. Working with one alone, what could, what is, and not what could be can kill you. And I can talk more about that. Yes.
State those again.
Yes. What is? What is going on? Especially, and this is a phrase from Dietrich Bonhoeffer, evil that parades as good, that hides as inevitable or social necessity or good. Second, what could and should be. And is emerging, I would say. And third, the power and presence of the Great Spirit luring us toward what could and should be. Does that help?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I'm not going to go further into that tool because we talked about it some yesterday and we don't have all day today. But I'd like to spend, so in a sense, let's get that one. Let's go to the second tool. I refer to it as recalling that we are not primarily an I. We are a we. It's rethinking who the human being is. And this comes back up to what Rick was saying earlier, a few moments ago. Whatever I see, see yourself not as an I, but as part of a vast community of communities throughout the ages. Within faith traditions, the community of communities living toward ways of life, organizing our communities and our societies more in line with God's rules for living. That is, loving neighbor and serving and preserving the earth. So seeing ourselves as part of a cloud of witnesses throughout time, and that cloud of witnesses today is those people dedicated to equitable, ecological ways of living. And that movement today, as I mentioned yesterday, is the fastest, is the largest movement, social movement in human history. The movement of people throughout the globe that are saying, enough. We will generate ways of living that serve Earth's well-being because we need Earth, and that enable people to live more equitably and all people to have what they need. So hold in mind that what I do, holding in mind only what I do or what my congregation with its solar panels does or what the ELCA does or what one community does is very discouraging. But to see the work of one person, one congregation, one community as part of a vaster whole, a huge movement, is much less discouraging. What I do is always going to be inadequate. What we as a whole do isn't. So, I would suggest to you that the church is beautifully situated to re-understand the human being as a we. In baptism, we claim that we're freed from being just autonomous individuals, isolated individuals, into being part of a community. We're woven into the church in baptism. The way this plays out to me, I think, in climate work is to understand ourselves to be called to co-labor or collaborate with others locally and around the globe. So if your church decides to head up some kind of a promote a citywide or statewide tree planting campaign to sequester carbon from the air, do it in relationship to, get in touch with, connect with Dr. Frederick Hsu of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Tanzania, who's known as the Tree Bishop, due to his work planting trees in Tanzania. He has spearheaded the Lutheran Church in Tanzania to launch an environmental action, long-term strategic environmental action plan. Be in relationship to that movement in Tanzania. Or if your synod takes on a five-year project to generate sustainable local agriculture infrastructure, do that in relationship with others in the community creating sustainable local agriculture, or with the national movement to do that. So see our actions as part of a we. Another example I thought about was get in touch with the you're doing sustainable agriculture in touch with the Lutheran Church of Indonesia, who writes, I quote, "We are helping farmers practice sustainable agriculture and stop deforestation to mitigate climate impact." The Lutheran Church in Indonesia. I continue. "To utilize renewable energy sources, my church has set up a biogas plant which uses animal dung to produce energy. This initiative has been implemented in several places, including seminary, church, and institutions." Okay, so what a gift to relate to that arm. You know, you're an arm, here's an arm in another part of the world. So I am not an I am part of a huge we that is interfaith and ecumenical and global. The third tool that I want to suggest, we also mentioned yesterday, and that is to recognize the different levels of social organization on which change happens. We talked about household. Wait, I'll put five levels. And we talked about household, public policy, institutions of civil society, public policy, the corporate and other business world, and worldview or consciousness. Recognizing change happening on all five of those levels and those feeding each other. So often, some students will say, we need to get everyone to do lifestyle change, to recycle, to bring their plastic bags, to do da-da-da, to ride their bicycles, to not eat meat, da-da-da-da. We can't depend upon structural change, public policy, corporate, etc. Other students will say, wait a minute, we're not going to get there fast enough if we're depending upon lifestyle change. We need structural change. For instance, our friend in the back here, Cynthia, is that your name?
Yeah,
Cynthia. Yeah, exemplified that very well. I'm not as likely to just do the lifestyle change. We need some structural things that are going to make that happen. Other people will say, wait a minute, what we really need is big story change, the worldview change. We need big story change in theology, so that we re-understand theological concepts to be and ecologically sound. We need big story change philosophically in understanding who the human being is. Modernity taught us that we are isolated, autonomous individuals seeking to and needing to dominate. Modernity taught us that we are not part of the economy of Earth. We are apart from it. We are not animals, we are something else. So we need big story change to re-see ourselves as part of Earth's economy, that we are mammals. I agree with that. I gave a talk not terribly long ago called Adam Was Not a Guy, because Adam is not male. Adam was not a guy and Jesus was a mammal, to try to help us understand that human beings are mammals. Okay, I really like to help my students see that it's not just lifestyle change or just structural change or just story change, but that they all work together and that they're all necessary and that they feed each other and they open doors to one another. And I would like you to take a moment to either recall examples from Monday or new examples of how change happens on all, needs to happen and does happen on all five of these levels, and how they can enable change on the other levels. Are you with me here? Do you understand my question?
You mean things we've heard of that are happening?
Things you've heard of? Yes, things you've heard of, things you've seen, but maybe haven't framed that way. Or maybe you've seen them and haven't realized that, oh, this lifestyle change actually does feed public policy change. Or this lifestyle, this institutional change feeds worldview change. That you may not have thought about that interface, or things that could happen. So that you've seen or that could?
Well, certainly plastic bags, right? That our cities outlined plastic bags and straws and styrofoam just recently.
Okay.
Too. So I gotta be careful. I mean, our church now makes plastic bags. I mean, nice cloth bags that are very practical and are good for refrigerating.
Okay. And it took public policy.
Yeah.
It took change on the public policy. So we've just made what we require restaurants in the Bay Area that we can't offer plastic straws. Do you understand? They can't do it. You can only get a straw if you ask for it. They should just ban them, but they haven't. So what's going to happen? People are going to start, if they want a straw, they're going to carry their own bamboo straw or whatever. So that's a good example. Change on the institutional level. My seminary, which is going through this 3-year environmental certification process, one of the things that we're going to suggest to our seminary is that we give each student at orientation a little kit that has a knife, fork, and a spoon. Oops. Yes, a knife, fork, and a spoon. A knife, fork, and a spoon. As well as a metal lunch container. No, who said no plastics back here? A metal lunch container, and we'll have no plastics and no paper products. And a napkin, a cloth napkin. Are you with? So that's institutional. That's also going to feed worldview change. It's going to change. It's going to feed consciousness change. Yes.
So people used to smoke all the time.
Yeah.
And as that changed,
it's
really hard to find an ashtray anymore.
Yeah.
And so if one of those lifestyle changes sort of cascades down into, well, I'm not gonna make ashtrays anymore because nobody's gonna buy them. And so then it falls into the corporate.
Absolutely.
So if we got a movement at the household level, we could change corporate.
Yes. That is very, very one of the gateways to corporate change is consumer activism. Mm-hmm. So that's a powerful gateway to corporate change. And you can take that in all levels. If people with the monetary means decided, I am not going to buy food that isn't fair trade food, even though it costs twice as much. 5-10 years from now, food that's fair trade is not going to cost twice as much. Because it will, that renders corporate change, absolutely. Someone, I'm going to call upon, was it you that talked with me about Kaiser?
Yeah.
Do you want to bring that up?
So the question is...
can you be here up front?
I'm sorry. So the question is, how does one affect change in a large corporation?
Okay.
There's the benefit of if you are successful, you reach a lot of people.
Okay, and I'm going to interject with you for just a minute, because the large corporation she's talking about is Kaiser Permanente. How many know that?
Yeah.
Okay, Kaiser is a health provider. Okay, and so you, go ahead.
So I'm a nurse and I work in palliative care, so that's my job, but my avocation is climate change justice. And, you know, so how does one harness the power of an 80,000 member, you know, multiple, just huge number of employees, huge number of impact in multiple states? How does one as an individual, you know, try to harness the power of something that big, but also that impactful if you're successful?
Mm-hmm. So she's asking the question of, you know, people, what seems more disempowering than the and just think for a minute about the global corporation, than the global, even if Kaiser is more national, but corporate structures, people feel like you can't make an impact. So here's an example, like a little case study. So you're thinking about some of the profoundly climate change producing impact of Kaiser as it operates now. How could you change that? And that in itself, if it was publicly promoted, would promote other lifestyle changes on people as well as consciousness change. Right. What are some gateways? Name two or three climate impacts of Kaiser.
Well, solar panels on every Kaiser building.
Okay, that would make a huge difference.
That would make a huge difference. Advocation of a plant-based diet for both personal health and climate justice.
Okay.
That would make a huge difference.
Okay, very, very good. Very, very good. Another thought that I'm thinking about impact is, and this happened a couple of days ago in my household, I'm a member of Kaiser. And once again, I get my prescription, which is my medication, my thyroid medication, and what do I have? You've got this much pills, you know, 30 little pills in a bottle this tall, but you don't know it's going to get recycled. And it comes in a plastic bag, thick plastic, this big, with four pieces of paper inside. So the carbon footprint of my 30 thyroid pills is huge. So how would we impact? Okay, yes.
You're not supposed to recycle those pill bottles.
Well, look at the Amazon. Look at the recent Amazon. They got a lot of press. That small group within this giant corporation that came to the shareholder meeting. They got all kinds of press, and that was pretty exciting. You know, so maybe creating a coalition within Kaiser, you know, is the way to go. And you've got to have a publicist in the group and. You know, because the press is where it's at, kind of, and getting the word out.
Okay, so what you've done with that question, what you've done with that answer, and what I've done by recognizing we have 12 minutes left, is to say I'm going to look at the fourth tool, and I will call that, let's call it 10 fingers. On the hands of action for change. And the point I want to make here is that it is vitally important to recognize various forms of action. It can be daunting to think about how do we change this or that, this corporation, or how do we get to this end without recognizing or kind of breaking down the various forms of action that can lead to change towards equitable and ecological households, institutions, public policy, business, and worldviews. So let's just use that Kaiser example, maybe, or other examples. What? And I'd like to name a kind of typology for you. 10 different forms of action. It's not a concrete typology, and you might create a different typology. And these aren't all separate, but I would say they're all vital and intersecting forms of action. And one that you've already named is lifestyle change. Another that we've named is public policy advocacy. But name two, or let's get out one example of public policy that hasn't been named thus far.
Voting.
Pardon?
Voting.
Voting, exactly, yes. Yes, electoral advocacy goes right with public policy. One public policy on a national level or local level that could reduce carbon emissions.
Tort reform.
Pardon me?
Tort reform.
Tort reform. Okay, say a little tiny bit more.
Well, you're talking about the four pages of paper and
yes.
If you don't have that, that from the legal liability limits and stuff like that, that would cause a nightmare for whoever is producing it.
Okay. So work on the legal level.
Yes.
Yes. Good. One other.
Infrastructure.
Okay, I'm just asking for public policy stuff now.
Right, that is kind of.
Yes, go for it. Okay. Yes, go for it. You're right. Public policy related to infrastructure.
Absolutely. Transportation is a huge carbon issue, and it could be politically framed.
Yes.
For the planet.
Absolutely. So public policy around transportation, enabling public transportation to be easy, accessible, safe, and usable. Yeah. Okay, so lifestyle change, public policy advocacy, economic advocacy. is the third form of action. By that, I mean boycotts. How many of you have taken part in boycotts for justice issues? All right. Fair trade, buying fair trade. How many have done that? Okay, these are forms of economic advocacy. Socially responsible investing.
That's the hard
one. Okay. What about, are you familiar with the divestment movement? Divestment yes. in fossil fuels? Complicated? Yes. Controversial? Yes. A large movement. If you go to the website of greenfaith.org and choose the divestment and reinvestment, you can see lists of the church-related and university-related communities that have committed to divesting from fossil fuels and reinvesting. It includes Lutheran World Federation. It includes the World Council of Churches. It includes the Church of Sweden, a number of denominations in the U.S., so economic advocacy is a powerful form of action.
Did you say greenspace.org?
Green faith.
Greenfaith.org.
Community, the next one is community organizing campaigns. I would say that community organizing campaign oriented around Kaiser Permanente, initiated by various groups working together, but an organizing campaign that would strategically plan for 10 moves that Kaiser could do to challenge Kaiser to become carbon neutral, to be the first HMO worldwide to be carbon neutral by 2020. And what promotion that would be for Kaiser, how it would draw in people, and what it would mean. So we've got lifestyle change, public policy, economic advocacy, community organizing campaigns. The next one I'm going to say comes back to you who mentioned media. Who was it that mentioned media? Yes. And I'll say education and consciousness raising. All of the efforts to raise people's awareness. And you're right, media is central in that. The next form of action that I'd like to name is worship and liturgical, everything that goes with worship and preaching and liturgical art. Give me some examples of earth-honoring worship, liturgical art, preaching. That you're aware, resources for that or experiences of it?
Minimal copying.
Okay, minimal copying, excellent. Churches deciding not to use all that paper? Very good, yes.
One thing we did in the Minneapolis Synod was did a whole effort around water stewardship. So we partnered with watershed districts and did some of those local and lifestyle projects.
Uh-huh.
But then at our Synod assembly, we had the deans from each conference bring a jar of water from their watershed, and we poured the jars of water into the common baptismal font and talked about our baptismal promise to steward and see ourselves as a part of the whole.
Okay, beautiful. Wow. Integrated into liturgy. Awareness that we are parts of vulnerable watersheds. And as church, we, not as eyes, can participate with others to restore watersheds, and then baptize in that water. Mm-hmm. Beautiful. Other examples of liturgy, of worship, preaching, resources or experiences. Remember, worship from, I'll be right there with you, worship from the most ancient of times was believed to form people. Worship was believed to form people morally and spiritually to live as God would have us live. That would mean that worship today would be forming us to re-see ourselves as creatures who serve and preserve. Those are the words in the Hebrew, abat and shamar, the garden, the Garden Eden. So how else would worship and preaching, who had her, yes?
Well, we have a church that just worships outside. They don't have a building. And we do have outdoor worship areas, and I think that people being outside, it causes a paradigm shift where they're not into convenience and, oh, it's too hot, oh, there's bugs. And I think that caring for God's creation requires a paradigm shift on a very basic level, like this experiential level. And so the church can be a huge part of that.
Ooh, so we should have just quoted you and used you for my talk, because you're paradigm shift. That's the worldview level. Are you from Living Springs in Texas?
No.
Dripping Springs.
Yeah, so Pastor Carmen from that church says that when you continue to worship outside, regardless of the weather, it creates a new reliance on God to bring the holy despite what we cannot control.
Okay, beautiful. You can look it up on your Googling. It's called Dripping Springs Lutheran Church. No?
It's called New Life.
New Life.
New Life Church. And it's in Dripping Springs.
Yes, and they're a part of the Wild Church
Network. New Life Lutheran, it's part of, this is a profound resource, the Wild Church Network. A network of churches reclaiming outdoors as God's temple.
Wow.
And yes, it does lead, I've been there, and it does lead to a paradigm shift. It also draws in a whole hell of a lot, a heck of a lot of people to the worship site, because it's moving to be outdoors. It's very Jesus-like. Okay. Other ideas, yes.
Acknowledging in the liturgy that we're worshiping on stolen land, what that means about our greed and tying in greed and the climate.
Excellent. Yes, we had Earth Honor in worship last night. Do you remember the emphasis on the elements of creation? The resources are. This is shooting up all over the place. Earth honoring forms of liturgy in the African earthkeeping churches, indigenous African earthkeeping churches. Every Eucharist they plant a tree. Every Eucharist, they plant a tree. If you go to, and we have liturgical resources created out there for worship that honors, in a very, very deeply Christian worship that honors the earth, one place to find those resources is on the website of Lutherans Restoring Creation. Go there and then click the worship. Or liturgical aspects of it. That's another of the fingers, worship and liturgy. Another of the fingers on the hands of change is theology, rethinking theology and Bible study. And I'm conscious of time, so I'm just going to name some resources there. One is the Earth Bible Series, which is a series of books that help us reread the Bible from the perspective of the earth. I like to say that the three tasks of theology are critique, reclaiming, and rebuilding. And critique means critiquing. Do theological study in your churches and synods that critiques the ways in which Christian beliefs and practices have betrayed God's love for the earth. So critique the ways we have understood salvation. The story of salvation as between God and humankind alone, and the earth was just a big stage on which it all took place. But when you begin to relook at theology, that's not the case at all. From the earliest times, we've seen the story of God redeeming the entirety of the cosmos. Not just the human animal, but the entirety. So I always say that to be faithful, one must be critical of where, do you know, the word tradition in the New Testament was first used as a verb. It appears first as a verb. And it means to pass on, to tradition the gospel, to pass it on. And it means to betray. So when Judas betrayed Jesus into the hands of those who would crucify him, the word betray is tradition. So our tradition is going to both betray and pass on the good news. So we must be critiquing where it has betrayed. okay, critique and then reclaim where tradition, reclaim the earth-honoring voices and then rebuild our theologies. Now, because of time, we're going to end in about 3 minutes, and I'm going to quickly name the other fingers on the hands of change. One is public witness, including demonstrations. The Palestinian bishop calls demonstrations evangelical defiance. The next is building small-scale economic, that is business alternatives and agricultural alternatives. And the final one is funding and supporting people hurt by climate disasters. So those are 10 fingers on the hands of change. Now, let us just say that a great calling is before us. The great work of humankind in the 21st century is to rebuild ways of being human that sustain Earth's life systems and reduce the gap between those who have too little and those who have too much. The great calling of the church is to plumb the depths of our traditions for our wisdom, our spiritual and moral wisdom to bring to that great work. Are you with me? If Christians don't plumb Christian traditions for the gifts therein to serve this great work of our day, no one else will. God's gifts to humankind through the church to serve God's calling of life abundant for all will not be used if Christians don't seek them out. That is our calling. Towards that end, we've explored 4 tools. The tool of critical mystical vision, the tool of acting as a we, not an I, the tool of seeking and intersecting change on those 4 levels, and 10 fingers of kinds of action on the hands of social change. It is our blessed calling as church to receive and honor and relish the justice-seeking, earth-honoring love of God, and then to breathe that love into the world by the way we live. So thank you for, in this hour, entering into and participating in that great work.